pleasure to be here. I want to thank the organizers very much for giving me an opportunity to talk in this session and in the conference. I want to talk about some recent work on quantum foundations, which is part of a larger project. The work itself is described in two papers on the archive. The larger project, which has to do with the nature of laws in cosmology and subsequent or consequences for the nature of time, is in two books, one, Time Reborn, which was just published, and the other with Roberto Mangabeira Unger, The Singular Universe and the Reality of Time, which is forthcoming. The aim of this project is to really rethink what is the nature of a law of physics on a cosmological scale. And we'll see that there are three key ideas that motivate the work and that therefore motivate new attempts and new ideas about quantum foundations. The first idea is that many of the problems that we face in quantum gravity and cosmology in fundamental physics arise from a kind of category mistake, and that's taking the framework that we use for laws of physics, the standard framework which we're all usually talking within and working within, which I'll characterize in a moment, and extending it uncritically to a theory of cosmology. That's the first thought. And there is a series of reasons why, both in general and in the particular case of quantum physics, that's the wrong thing to do. By the standard framework, we mean what we sometimes call the Newtonian paradigm, that we have a fixed space of states on which a fixed dynamical law acts to give dynamics on that space of states. And we can have an interesting discussion afterwards as to whether history's formulations of the kind we just heard about fit into that standard framework or also an attempt to make a departure from it. The second, so if you buy the first conclusion, then a new approach is needed to extend physics to the cosmological scale, to address new questions that arise on the cosmological scale, such as accounting for the laws and accounting for the initial conditions. The laws and initial conditions being usually inputs to the standard Newtonian framework, standard way of doing physics. The next conclusion, if you buy the first one and buy that a new approach is needed to address cosmological questions, is that laws must be evolving. Laws cannot be taken as fixed, but must be taken as evolving if they're to have an explanation which is scientific, by which I mean has ramifications or implications which can be checked by further experiment, further observations. And the third idea or assertion is that if laws are to evolve, then time must be taken seriously as being real, in a sense stronger than just our dealing with histories or functions of time in the sense of models that we usually have been working with. So I'll be briefly motivating these three ideas, and then I'll be talking about two approaches to foundation, to quantum foundations, which are motivated by them, which are both in progress and incomplete. Okay, now, David Finkelstein likes to say that if you want to make a conceptual leap on a foundational problem, it's good to get a running start and to go back to the history and philosophy of science. So I like, and I hope it's not pretentious to do this in this audience, I like to go back to the principle of sufficient reason of Leibniz, not as an up and down principle that come what may must be satisfied, but as an aspiration that we should always seek to advance towards the goal of having a sufficient reason for all cosmological questions. This has some implications for the practice of physics right away, that there are no fundamental symmetries, because a fundamental symmetry falls askew of the principle of the identity of the indiscernible, which I'll be introducing in a minute, that space and time should be discussed in a relational context. Further, the idea, as happens in several approaches to quantum gravity, including loop quantum gravity, spin foams, causal sets, causal dynamical triangulation is that there's a more fundamental structure which is essentially graphical or relational that space, maybe space-time emerge from. And a key opportunity arises here for quantum foundations that if space is emergent, then so is locality, and therefore a theory that is fundamentally non-local may be more palatable. And I will make strong use of that in the following. Related to the principle of sufficient reason, a principle that I will use strongly in a few minutes, the principle of explanatory closure, that everything that causally influences the behavior of a physical system within the universe must be another physical system within the universe. And I will use that just to anticipate in the sense of the following. Whenever an ensemble appears in an explanation of some physical outcome, as often is the case in different interpretations of quantum physics, people variously argue that the quantum state refers to an ensemble. That ensemble should not be some abstract entity, some transcendent entity, some entity outside of the dynamical system. That ensemble has to be a collection of real physical systems in the universe. And that I will examine hypotheses in which the ensemble that the quantum state describes are real ensembles of real physical systems in the universe at the present time or in the past. And the principle of reciprocity, that there's nothing in nature that acts without being acted on. This, of course, was famously introduced by Einstein in his arguments for general relativity. And we mean to use it in a stronger sense, in which that would apply also to the idea of laws of nature. Laws of nature are things that act to cause things to happen in the universe. There therefore must be, if you buy the principle of reciprocity, a possibility of laws of nature also being acted back on by the state of the universe. And the principle of the identity of the indiscernible that I'll also use to suggest a move in quantum foundations, that if two systems have the same relational properties with respect to the rest of the universe, they are the same system. They are not identical systems in nature. Okay. So I mentioned already the three points of the general argument, which I'll now go into in a little bit, what we call the cosmological fallacy. The fallacy is the taking of a framework for physics which is appropriate for small subsystems, for laboratory systems, and extending it to cosmology uncritically, the need for real time, and the idea that laws must evolve in that real time if they're to be explained. So let me talk about the cosmological fallacy in the context of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, as is usually formulated, has a clean separation between two ingredients, the Hilbert space, which is the space of states, and the dynamical law, whether it's described in terms of a path integral or a Hamiltonian evolution, gives dynamics on that space of states. Both are given a priori. You don't evolve the state and then discover some more states the system might be in that you didn't know about. As might be argued, happens in biology, for example. You don't change the law as the system is evolving. Okay. The application of quantum mechanics to real experiment makes good use of the separation between laws and states, or also laws and initial conditions. Initial conditions are possible, initial states, because the experimentalist controls the initial conditions and can vary the initial conditions in order to test hypotheses about the state, about the law, about the dynamics. The dynamics are supposed to hold generally, that is, in many different experimental situations with many different initial conditions whose possibility is expressed by the character of the space of states. Okay. So the framework is well suited to looking for general laws in a large class of experimental situations that we control as observers. Is it well suited for cosmology? Certainly not, and many issues arise from it. The fact that we don't control the initial conditions. To put that more strongly, when we're doing cosmology, we simultaneously posit and simultaneously test hypotheses as to the laws, for example, in the inflationary era, and hypotheses as to the initial conditions. And there tend to be degeneracies in interpreting cosmological observations in which the same observation or possible observation can be explained by changing the laws at early times or changing the initial conditions. So the clean separation, which is good empirical content for between laws and initial conditions, don't hold in cosmology. There's also, of course, as came up importantly in the last talk, just one wave function of the universe or one measure in the history's formulation. Okay. What is the role in a cosmological context of all those states which are never realized in the history of the universe? Because there is just one state in the Hilbert space of cosmology, of a cosmological model, which gets to be, quote, real, which gets to be realized. The fact that there are an infinite number of states explains too little and explains too much. It explains too little because it doesn't explain, it has no way to explain why a particular state out of the infinite number of states in Hilbert space is realized as the wave function of the universe. It explains way too much because you can take any of the other states and get a whole realm of predictions for non-existent universes. So again, there's a mismatch between the mathematical framework, the structure of the mathematical framework, and the empirical situation when we're doing cosmology. I don't have to tell this audience that there is a huge controversy about whether there is an interpretation for the wave function of the universe that makes sense. David mentioned it several times in his talk and comments. As somebody who works on quantum gravity, as somebody who started his work on quantum gravity by constructing solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, I'm fed up. That is, I think that the idea of the semi-classical universe, a quote, emerging from exact solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in practice is much harder than it looks, and we've been basically stuck at that point for 25 years. And when you're stuck on a technical point long enough, you begin to wonder if you just have the wrong instructions for how to proceed. Okay. And then finally, if laws do not evolve, if laws are immutable, as is given in the standard framework, then they're outside of explanation. We simply have to accept these are the laws of nature, the ones that fit experiment best, but the further question, why these are the laws and not others, is unanswerable. And that's a huge limitation on the principle of sufficient reason, as Charles Sanders Peirce suggested in this famous quote. So I won't read the whole quote, But the black point, he basically states the principle of sufficient reason and argues that nothing more is in need of explanation than why these are the laws. And then he states in red, the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature is to suppose them the results of evolution. And the way that I read that, the only possible way of accounting for the choice of the laws of nature that is has empirical content, i.e., that leads to further hypotheses which can be checked by experiment, is if there is some causal process acting through the past which changed the laws and made them the way they are, because then there are consequences because you're looking at things that happened in the past. Thank you for that, Jan. The meta-law dilemma is a key dilemma which arises, because maybe there's a meta-law, but then we're back to the same question of why this meta-law apparently, okay? On the other hand, if there's no meta-law and things just kind of change sometimes without sufficient reason, then there's a limitation to sufficient reason, okay? What I believe, it's not a point of this talk to argue, but it's a point of other talks to argue, that this is a solvable dilemma. This is one of those dilemmas in science which is not represented dead end, is productive, because there are hypotheses about the evolutions of laws which are not subject to the meta-law dilemma, to the infinite regress. And I'll be discussing one of them, but that's not the main subject here. Yes, David?
So maybe we shouldn't be starting a long discussion now, but just here's maybe a slightly different way of putting the same confusion that is on my part. Explaining things is usually an activity of showing how some things that you find to be the case about the world follow in one way or another from other things
Sure. That
you find to be the case about the world. It's a matter of linking things together. You start someplace and you end up someplace else. It sounds like you have an aspiration for explanations that don't have a starting point. But I don't know what that means or what that would look like.
That's, aspiration is the right word. And I think if the aspiration causes us or inspires us to make hypotheses which are checkable by falsifiable predictions, and if we can then engage in checking them, then we're doing science and we're extending the range of science further towards the aspiration. That's what I attempted to say at the beginning. I don't claim that the aspiration can be realized at any point in the development of science, but it's an aspiration to keep in mind, and aspirations like Peirce has in mind here and like I have in mind are motivational. So let's see where it goes. An example of an approach to evolving laws, which is not part of this talk, but was my initial inspiration, is this idea of cosmological natural selection. And maybe in the discussion I can defend the thesis that that is not subject to all the problems in the metal-law dilemma, because it's a very weak statistical hypothesis. But I want to introduce a different one in this talk. Okay, I really said most of this transparency, but now if you're on board to the project of trying to find a new way to do cosmological physics, the second claim comes in that this unknown theory that we're looking for, which has to have the property that when you truncate it to small subsystems of the universe, reproduces quantum mechanics, will require a notion of a real time. And by real time, I mean two things. One of them is that ontologically, what's real is real in the present. And I'm willing to include the past, but not the future. So if you push me onto my ontology, I'm willing to include the past, but the important statement is that the future is not real in the way that the present and perhaps the past is. And there is an objective distinction between a completed past and a partially open future. Okay, and just take this as a claim. Let's not argue about this because there are different points of view. Let's argue about this in the discussion session. But this is the project that Unger and I have been engaged in. And the fruit of the project is the particular hypotheses, and I'll be coming shortly to two particular hypotheses about quantum theory. Let me just mention, as has been mentioned, I'm sure, in this conference before, that several realist approaches to quantum mechanics require a violation of the relativity of simultaneity, both hidden variable theories, as in Bohm's mechanics, and collapse models, require that there be a preferred simultaneity, and this view that we're taking is friendly to that. In fact, that leads me to, I have to address right away the next query. What about the powerful experimental evidence for special and general relativity, which supports the relativity of simultaneity, which goes against what I've just been positing? And here, this is a talk in itself, but a very important development in classical general relativity has to be mentioned here, called shape dynamics. And shape dynamics is a recent reformulation of general relativity, which has fixed preferred spatial slices, which are, if you know the jargon, constant mean curvature slices, and is a theory that trades the relativity of time for the relativity of size. And to put it more technically, if I can, in general relativity, there is a Hamiltonian constraint, which you gauge fix with some gauge fixing condition to compute absolute actual evolution. And you, one gauge fixing condition is to fix to constant mean curvature slices, slices in which the trace of the extrinsic curvature is constant on slices. If you know the technical jargon, together these make a second class system. The Hamiltonian constraint, which with, of course, the Diffeo constraints, are first class, and this makes the system second class. Okay. Interestingly enough, one way to put the discovery of the shape dynamics people who are listed on the slide, Julian Barber and collaborators, and Gomez, Grib, Kowalski, Mercati, others, is you can switch the roles and take the constant mean curvature condition and the diffeomorphism constraints as constraints which generate a gauge symmetry, and the Hamiltonian constraint as gauge fixing. And this is shape dynamics. To say it more hand-wavingly and physically, consider a light clock, consider a sphere with photons bouncing back and forth inside of it that define a clock, a sphere, mirrored sphere. Make two of them, take them around two paths in space-time, and they will have ticked, the photons will bounce a different number of ways. That's usually a measure of the relativity of time. In this reformulation of general relativity, that can be traced to a relativity of the size of the light clocks, to the same gauge invariant result, which is a difference in the number of clocks that they tick. So this development lets us have all the experimental support for the principles of special and general relativity in their context, but believe that our universe is a universe with fixed spatial slices without a many-finger time gauge invariance. And I think that this is something that people in foundational aspects of science, of physics, should know more about. So I hope it's okay I took 5 minutes to describe it. What about the strong success of the practice of the standard way of doing physics with immutable laws acting on immutable state spaces? There is no problem with that, and there's no questioning of that. Essentially, what we would assert is that the correspondence between records of observations, of past observations, which are, of course, frozen, quote, in time, once you've made a set of records of a set of observations, those records just exist and can be modeled by a mathematical object, which is also timeless. And you can ask about the correspondence between the mathematical object and the records of past observations of some experiment. And that's a very good way of doing non-cosmological physics. But the claim that it doesn't extend to cosmology should stop you from making silly metaphysical assertions like the world is mathematical, or the world is really fundamentally akin to a mathematical object. Okay, now.
Sorry, but by that you mean the unchanging of the results of experiments we have done at a certain time and done later. But what about evidence of the laws of physics holding, let's say, at the time of recombination?
Just wait. I'm going to surprise you with an answer to that. That's a very good question. So now I'm on the last slide of the motivation, and I want to come back to the principle of explanatory closure and make the point that I made earlier, because this is the point to make it, that if an ensemble influences an individual system, if I have to theoretically posit an ensemble to talk about the properties of an individual system, that ensemble had better exist physically. Every single last member of that ensemble had better be a physical system in the universe. That's what we take the principle of explanatory closure to mean. So let's consider the ground state of a hydrogen atom in the laboratory. If there's an ensemble, if you want to take the view that the quantum state corresponds to ensemble, that ensemble has to exist somewhere. And there are two possible places to look for that ensemble: in the present, in other hydrogen atoms that exist at the present moment, which I just argued can be objectively stated, or in the past. And I'm going to take those in the opposite order. Both require that the notion of the present be physically meaningful, but again, note that we already know if we want to have a realist interpretation of quantum states, we need to break the relativity of simultaneity. So when I posit the ensemble in the present, that's called the real ensemble formulation. When I posit the ensemble in the past, that's called the principle of precedence. And I'm going to take the second one first. Now, Daniel would say, what about the following? If we prepare evolve and measure a quantum system we have studied many times in the past, and I'm reading from the slide because the sentence is important. The response will be just as if the outcome of the present case of the measurement were randomly selected from the ensemble of past instances of that preparation measurement. If I have a quantum system, I prepare and then measure a quantum system, there's a set of outcomes, there's a probability distribution for that set of outcomes, and that probability distribution is stable over time, which means a way to say that that probability distribution is stable over time is that I can consider it's just as if the outcome of any individual test that I do right now is picked randomly from the ensemble of past instances, because it will be picked from the probability distribution given by the appropriate quantum state, the appropriate density matrix. Okay. Now, why is that? Usually we think that that's because there are timeless laws. There are laws that act in the past the same way that they act in the present, the same way they will act in a billion years and 10 billion years. The same laws are acting. Okay, you agree so far? Okay. I want to claim that that's a wild idea. The idea that there are laws that act in time but somehow exist outside of time is metaphysically a very heavy piece of baggage to maintain. The idea that violates the principle of reciprocity, it violates the principle of explanatory closure. What are these laws of nature? How do they, and I just want to make you nervous about the whole idea of laws of nature somehow immutable and timeless, acting from outside the world to make things happen in the world. How does an electron know to satisfy the right version of the Dirac equation and not to evolve like a quark? There's a lot of bits of metaphysical baggage here. Let's see if we can do without them. I would propose we can do without them if we take the same sentence that I read carefully and cross out the "as if the outcome were." Crossing out that bit gives me the following statement: if we prepare and measure a quantum system we have studied many times in the past, the response will be randomly chosen from the ensemble of past instances of that preparation and measurement. Full stop. Yeah.
Does this principle of precedence act from outside of time?
It acts. Well, that's a great question. The answer is it's a different peculiar metaphysical assumption.
It sounds like it has all the flaws of the assumption you were just
criticizing. Of course it does. It's just different.
Why is that a good thing?
Because it may have empirical content.
Okay.
Yeah?
We have a system that, according to usual quantum mechanics, has 2,000 possible outcomes. And we've only studied it 1,900 times before. Does that mean there are 100 outcomes that we think we might be able to get that actually we can't get?
Let me come to your question in another slide. I have a slide for your question. Okay. This is a proposal which is made half in jest and half seriously. The intention of this proposal is to open up a space for new concepts of law that could function on a cosmological scale and demonstrate the larger point, which is hypotheses about how laws might have come to evolve to be what they are in time can often have empirical content. Now, to explain, to make a detailed theory of this principle, the action of this principle, which I don't have, you would have to talk about what similarity means in detail. You would have to explicate how the probability for something to happen can depend and why it can depend. Is it, quote, from principle acting from outside of time on the ensemble of past instances? This is a very non-local assertion, okay? And that's in progress, and I'm not going to, there's work with Marina Cortez that addresses that, that I discussed a little bit at a recent Quantum Foundation seminar here, but I'm not going to go into that here. I just want to mention that this is a wild idea. It requires some development. The development is in progress. It may work, it may not. But the interesting question for empirical content, which is related to the question just asked, is what happens when there's no precedent or when there's incomplete precedent? And the claim has to be that you would expect experimental results which differ from taking the Schrodinger equation, choosing a dynamics given your knowledge of the subsystems, and drawing predictions from it. So what we have in mind when we talk about systems without precedent are entangled states of large quantum systems, such as can be made in a quantum information laboratory, in which you could ask the experimentalist to prepare quantum states which have not been previously existed, which has not previously existed in nature. And the claim would be that until precedence was established, until these states had been studied quite a bit, with exactly what quite a bit means being undefined without a detailed theory, the behavior would not be subject, the outcomes would not be the same as would be predicted by the Schrodinger equation with the potentials that we know. And this is a wild claim, but it's testable. And that's the point I want to make. Also, I'm very interested in discussions about details of testing this. And I can tell you the little bit that I know if people want to come back in the discussion. Okay. So that's, yes?
So does that mean, suppose that if there's some system and some preparation procedure in a lab, if the identical preparation procedure has been performed many times, then this preparation procedure acts like all of those. But if it's never been prepared before, then it acts differently. Does my preparation procedure know whether many things have been prepared identically or not? Does it know whether to act in an old way or in a new way?
Yes, well, the hypothesis is that it does.
There was some biologist, maybe somebody here remembers his name, I don't remember who it was, in the 60s, I think, who had an idea that sounds, who talked about things when they happen once, this is obviously a very sort of metaphorical kind of language, but when something happens for the first time, it makes a little scratch in the world. And when it happens for the second time, it deepens it a little bit into a groove.
Yeah.
And it makes it easier and easier for the same sort of thing to happen towards the future. Anybody remember Rupert Sheldrake? That sounds like a similar image to the kind of thing you.
Yes, and I don't know. I presume that's a bad thing, but I. So some people who are mutual friends have put me in touch with him.
Oh.
And I have not read his stuff, so I can't
right.
comment on it.
Okay. Good.
But.
Good. I wasn't misremembering. Good.
Okay. That was the first idea. Yes. Let me
come.
Possibly. I've been thinking about that. I'm not sure, but possibly. So then you would have to go back. The issue, when I have discussed this in detail with experiments, an issue that arises is that experiments never work the first time or the first few dozen times anyway. So you would want to set up a situation where you could tell by the statistics the difference between the experimentalist getting the experiment together and damping down the system, the noise and so forth, from this new source of stochasticity.
Wouldn't that say that no experiment, since they don't work the first few times, they should never work?
No.
Because the results are drawn from the ensemble of...
No, because most things that we do have natural precedents, that have been happening for billions of years. Okay. First idea, I can see that this is going over great. So let me come to the second idea. But that's fine. That's fine. The first idea is intended to be a little bit wild and intended to make the point that I made about evolvability of laws being very subject to testability. Okay. Here's the second idea, which was the first idea historically, the first idea that occurred to me. That is, this is the idea that the ensemble that quantum state refers to are to be found in systems at the same time. So this is the so-called real ensemble formulation of quantum mechanics. And it was really motivated by thinking about de Broglie-Bohm and trying to have an approach to quantum foundations which got the success, which could help itself to the successes of de Broglie-Bohm without the difficulties, and one of the prime difficulties is the double ontology. So if we look at the wave function, we like to think that the wave function is a function over Biables. I'll take position, although I'm flexible as to what the Biables are. And we like to decompose the wave function as the square root of a probability density times e to the I, a phase, both of which depend on the Biables x and time. And certainly, the probability distribution looks like a property of an ensemble. The phase doesn't look like a property of an ensemble. And attempts to make a real solid ensemble formulation of quantum theory, for example, the Nelson Brownian motion formulation, which I work with for some years, usually falter on your inability to really give an ensemble interpretation to the phase of the wave function. And this leads to the necessity of having a double ontology in the de Broglie-Bohm framework. So I want to start to attack the problem there and propose an ontology where each individual system in the ensemble has a phase, and the function S of the Biables is a kind of collective way of describing the distribution of phases of the individual systems which have Biables x. In other words, the Biables we'll hypothesize are a position and a phase. And the Schrodinger equation will reflect the interplay between the dynamics of the individual and the dynamics of the ensemble in a new way. So the detailed description of the system, I assume there's an ensemble. There are n systems in the ensemble, which I'm going to assume are real. If we're talking about hydrogen atoms in the ground state, I'm going to talk about the ensemble of all the hydrogen atoms in the ground state in the universe at the given time. The knowledge of all the Biables is a knowledge of the positions and the phases for all members of the ensemble. And by positions for an atom, I mean the relative position between the nucleus and the electron. And the Schrodinger equation reflects the interplay between the dynamics of the individual and the ensemble. And we're going to try to see if we can get away with having the phase information not be a separate ontological piece, but be reflecting all the individual phases of all the individual systems.
Can I ask you a stupid question? I would see the phase as an ensemble property in all practical experiments. Because you can never measure the phase of a single, you need a reference anyhow. So if I do an experiment, I see the phase only in the ensemble.
And you'll see that relative phases come in. Just let me go a few steps to the actual formulation.
So you start with, as a many particle system, S of x comma t is a function of a configuration.
No, this is a single
part. This is a single part.
Yeah. It's not in this talk, but I have some slides prepared to address that issue. So ask me in the discussion session. But you're absolutely right. But then the question is, what counts as an individual system as opposed to a member of the ensemble? And I have a proposal for that. But I have to develop the language and the proposal before I can discuss that. Okay, so this is the idea that I've already stated, that the ensemble is nothing but the ensemble of real hydrogen atoms in the ground state in the universe at the present time. And what I have in mind is something like taking seriously the principle of the identity indiscernible seriously enough that if we're talking about identifying a system by its quantum state, that we can't tell the difference between different systems which differ by the values of their beables but have the same quantum state. And therefore, if I make a measurement in a laboratory of the beable of a given quantum state, I can get the value of that beable for any member of the ensemble of systems in the universe which have that quantum state. So there's a lot of non-locality I'm helping myself to. Now, 5 to 10 minutes, that's fine. Thank you. One claim that I can make right away and that I'll be developing in detail. So I'm going to invent an interaction amongst members of the ensemble which is going to reproduce the Schrodinger evolution for large ensembles. It's not going to reproduce the Schrodinger evolution for small ensembles or for systems that don't have copies that are unique. And so there's a distinction in this approach to quantum foundations between systems that come in many physical copies in the universe, like hydrogen atoms, and systems like cats that don't come in many copies, because each cat is unique enough that there is no copy. And this is going to be the resolution of the measurement problem and the Schrodinger cat problem. Basically, quantum dynamics is not going to be derivable for systems which are large and complex enough not to have copies in the universe. Okay, so this just summarizes where we are so far. And now for the specifics of the proposal. So, to say it more formally, quantum mechanics describes a small subsystem S of the universe. It has beables, some B, which is a function of T, which I've been taking to be the position and a phase. The members of the ensemble are similarly constituted and similarly prepared. There are a finite number but large number of systems in the ensemble. The total state, microstate, is the beables for the whole ensemble. And now I need some language. So N of B is a number of systems in the ensemble with beable B at time T. And I make an auxiliary hypothesis, which is that the dynamics evolves to the point where the phases are aligned, where the phases of two systems in the ensemble which have the same beable B are the same. And later I propose a dynamics for the evolution of the phases themselves, which realizes this, which evolves so that the phases get locked in alignment. Hence, the ensemble has a probability density rho of B and a phase phi of B when the phases are aligned. Okay, and for the first pass, where I'm going to skip the dynamics by which the phases do get aligned because that's a separate discussion. But again, I can do that in the discussion section. Okay. Now, the main dynamical hypothesis is that the beables evolve by copying the beables of other systems in the ensemble. So this functions both something like a collapse postulate and something and to reproduce the Schrodinger evolution. So if I have a hydrogen atom, here's the nucleus, here's the position, and there's an ensemble of other hydrogen atoms in the universe, the position of the electron relative to the nucleus will from time to time just copy the position of another hydrogen atom somewhere in the ensemble in the universe.
So then the ensemble is for the whole universe for all times or at some
at fixed time. Fixed time. Okay. So there is some probability that I have to assert what it is that the subsystem, the system I in the ensemble copies the beables of the system J, and I can give a functional form of this probability such that the result, the net result, is that the Schrodinger equation describes the dynamics of the ensemble. When it happens, both the ordinary beable, say the position beable, is copied and the phase is copied. In addition, on top of that, let me maybe, since I only have 5 more minutes, let me maybe make the whole proposal, get to the point where I assert the derivation of the Schrodinger equation, and then take questions, okay? So there's also a continuous evolution of the phase, which is a function of the other phases in the ensemble, the other beables, and the occupation numbers. Ni is the number of systems in the ensemble that have the same beables as the system I. So this is just a summary of the dynamics. And so the key idea is that the phases have a smooth evolution. And on top of the smooth evolution, which depends on all the other phases, with weights that depend on how common the beables are in the ensemble. And on top of that, there's a stochastic evolution where beables can copy elements, where systems can copy the beables of other systems. And the work is then to choose the evolution rules to reproduce quantum mechanics. And since I'm running short on time, let me just assert that there are rules which give the smooth evolution of the phases and which give the probability for the subsystem I to copy the beables of the subsystem J. And there are rules which are equivalent to Schrodinger evolution for the whole ensemble, for the wave function. The dynamics are specified by some free functions, RAB, which are like amplitudes for an interaction between systems with the beable A and the beable B. A and B are beable labels. Delta AB, which are phases. And these omegas, which are frequencies associated with each of the possible beable values. Needless to say, this is highly non-local. The probability for a system I to copy the beables of system J depends on the number of subsystems in the ensemble that have the same beables as I and the number that have the same beables as J. Depends on the phases of the system I and the phases J and so forth. So this is a highly non-local hypothesis. You have to imagine that, so the hidden variables, to use that language, for that tell you what's going to happen to the beables of a given hydrogen atom are the values of the beables and all the other hydrogen atoms in the universe. And this is just showing you that if you take the probability, the occupation numbers from which you can form probabilities for the different beables, and multiply them by their phases, you can make a wave function. You can put the data in those evolution rules in a Hamiltonian, and you can derive the Schrodinger equation. Okay, now, I'm almost done. Let me just note some things to discussion if people want to discuss it. The details of how you can get those rules from a natural set of assumptions governing the dynamics is promoted to discussion. The model for phase alignment is promoted to discussion. Let me just mention 3 issues that you have to deal with. The subsystem problem, which Rob mentioned, has to be addressed. What is the level of subsystems at which this dynamics applies? One has to say something about the classical limit, and there is something to say. And just like de Broglie-Bohm theory, there's an issue about getting stuck at nodes, which has to be mentioned and discussed. Possible empirical consequences, they're similar to the empirical consequences that I've been discussing for the principle of precedent, which is that if you can make in the laboratory a system that has no copies, an entangled state of a large number of qubits that presumably has no natural copies anywhere in the universe, it should not obey Schrodinger dynamics. So this should be easily falsifiable as quantum computing technology progresses, because quantum computers are certainly going to be dealing with combinatorially large sets of quantum states. That's the whole point of quantum computing, is dealing with combinatorially large sets of possible entangled states. And if quantum computers work according to the Schrodinger equation, then this proposal is false. Let me just get to the end. Another place where one can look for empirical deviations between the Schrodinger equation and this proposal is near nodes. If you look at a quantum state which has nodes in it, just like there's an issue for de Broglie-Bohm of things getting trapped to one side or another of a node, there's an issue here of things getting trapped. Okay, let me take questions now. Well, this you, the guy in the right here, had the question first. Yeah, you.
I was going to ask earlier, well, what would prevent that cat from putting another cat? Because you first made an assay, you first said that, okay, cats have no copies while hydrogen atoms do. But after that, you introduced the rule that hydrogen atoms copy the other hydrogen atoms. But if hydrogen atoms have copies because of that rule, then that same rule could be introduced for cats, and then cats would be copying other cats.
Right. So this is the subsystem issue. And let me just state the principle. The principle that I assert is that this copy dynamics, if imagine a nested series of subsystems that, you know, a hydrogen atom is part of a molecule which is part of a complex of molecules which is part of a cell which is part of a cat, at which point do you apply the copy dynamics? You apply the copy dynamics to the largest subsystem in which you can describe the system by a pure state, which is not a product of pure states of subsystems.
So the hydrogen atom has a side system, an electron and a proton.
Right, but they're deeply entangled in the energy eigenstates of a hydrogen atom.
But this is the difference quantitative, not qualitative. So, but on the other hand, copying is a qualitative thing. So there has to be, it's like a yes or no rule. Does the system copy the other system or no? So where do you draw that line between hydrogen atoms?
There are deltas and epsilons that I don't know exactly where they go. So that's a good point, and let's put that in the list of things for further development. Okay, Flavio?
The least imaginative way of falsifying this would be extraterrestrial quantization, so I can make it much easier.
Yes, I'd rather not save a scientific hypothesis by positing that there are extraterrestrial civilizations. But if you want to go that route, there's a great science fiction story to be written about how people use quantum computers to communicate instantaneously with those other civilizations.
If we're building these things,
yeah,
on your kind of view, isn't that in fact empirical evidence that there are extraterrestrial civilizations where they're building?
If they're working. If they work.
Right.
But on this view, that would be, yes. What Flavio is saying is perfectly correct.
Right.
So given, as you said, okay, quoting Quine.
No, forget about if they work. Just the fact that we're trying to build them. Okay. You ask, I don't know how you're exactly going to evaluate these probabilities, but you're going to have to weigh the probabilities that we're building them as a sort of random swerve of the world without precedent. You're going to have to compare that with the probability that we're building them because we're falling into a groove that has already been carved.
So first of all, the two ideas are not to be joined together. They're different ideas.
You mean the groove idea?
Yeah.
No, I was just using a metaphor. I mean that we're building them as a consequence, that we're building them as a consequence of the principle of precedence.
No. But the principle of precedence and this real ensemble formulation of quantum mechanics are similar.
Oh, okay.
but they're not the same idea. One of them uses an ensemble to the past, the other uses an ensemble to the
past.
Again, as you quoted Quine, let me just address this, because you never say something which is not serious, although this, one has to choose the where you're willing to make new hypotheses, where you're willing to abandon old hypotheses. And it seems to me, absent of other evidence for other civilizations, I would rather not save a hypothesis about the foundations of quantum mechanics by pointing to other civilizations. I would rather abandon the hypothesis in the hopes that other hypotheses of people in this room would triumph with the success of quantum computers. Rob?
I think it's follow up on this line. I'd like to see the quantum computer advancement there, as we've talked about before. But you didn't stress the key part of the argument that establishes why this would potentially falsify the theory, which is that if a finite number of elements and a choice for each, you can get an exponential number of quantum states. And it doesn't matter how long, but I mean, you know, the universe, supposing the universe has been around for finite time, it's finite in extent, it's only polynomial.
Yes, I snuck that in with that. Thank you very much for reminding me. I snuck that in when I said combinatorial large set of states, but that's spelling out what I was implying. So thank you.
So I have a new thought in that direction. So previously we were talking about entangled versus unentangled. That's the point of the theory. But if I understood you correctly, if I have a single particle and I prepared in a wave function that hasn't been seen before, then there's no reason to think it will obey quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Okay. So now here's my new example. So I want to claim that actually this failure of there being precedents occurs all the time for microscopic systems. It's not some sort of rare event, but actually microscopic systems generically have never seen, we've never seen their wave function before. So the example would be take an electron in the conduction band of some piece of solid with, I don't know, some large number of atoms and maybe Avogadro's number. You know, the particular sequence of defects you have in that solid, I don't know, maybe it's 1% defects, you know, 1% of Avogadro's number, that's an exponentially large number of ways of having a set of defects. That influences the potential the wave function sees. The ground state of that is one of, you know, you have exponentially large potentials, exponentially large number of potentials, therefore exponentially large number of ground states. Therefore, every one of those electrons is in a wave function that the world has never seen before. And so,
that's beautiful.
Applies very well to electron inductors.
So that's beautiful, and that may do it. Thank you. But let's think carefully about that. There's another step, just one more, but another step, which is, are we really sure that the electrons in conduction bands in metals are really satisfying to some accuracy that would be needed, the Schrodinger equation, as opposed to the Schrodinger equation with some modified potential? But that's a great thought, and this may be the last time I give this talk.
Isn't the principle also dependent on how we divide the world into subsystems? Because you tell us about this collection of hydrogen atoms, and I would describe that as, you know, just one single state of one single system, which is the electromagnetic field plus the field of the electron field and the proton field, or the corresponding quark field, which happens to have this particular
state.
It's just one system, the electromagnetic, the fields in the universe. There are no many systems.
So this is my attempt to deal with it, the subsystem problem, the claim here. There's a set of nested subsystems. Each is described by a density matrix. Each density matrix for a smaller subsystem arises by tracing degrees of freedom from the next largest subsystem. But there is only one level such that the density matrix on that level is pure and is not a product state. And that is what the copy hypothesis applies to. I have to single out some principle for some level of subsystems that the hypothesis can apply to, and that's my proposal.
But once again, that'll have to be vague, right? Literally speaking, there aren't any unentangled subsystems of the world.
Yes. Right. So this was pointed out. This has to be turned into a quantitative statement.
Idea. So, for instance, our experiments with large molecules, quantum interference with large molecules, these are molecules which do not exist anywhere in the universe, as far as I know. They have only been made for our purposes. And quantum interference is near to perfect, so to say. So I would say that that's a good argument why the model cannot work. And then there's a self-consistency issue. I mean, somewhere you have to start, and who's copying from whom, so to say. So if you do a measurement, nature must have had some laws in the beginning without copying from somewhere.
First of all, the two ideas are distinct. The two ideas are just, don't mix up the two ideas. But the issue about the buckyballs, interference effects, and so forth, the buckyballs. So I've thought about this not in enough detail, but the issue is, and I'd be very happy to discuss it with you, to what extent are we dealing with quantum states of center of masses, and to what extent are we really dealing with an entangled quantum state of a large number of degrees of freedom? And that's where the issue is. Also with respect to Bose-Einstein condensates and things like that.
So one of the ways in which this would produce something that's testable, I would think, it wouldn't be that that events didn't occur, but the events predicted by quantum physics, as is normally assumed with a completely random probability distribution, might not occur completely randomly. And this raises to me a question which maybe Marcus can answer, or somebody who knows the answer. This always puzzled me. People who design computer programs that produce quasi-random probability distributions. It may, the distribution may be totally random up to 10,000 places, but then there might be a repetition of a segment of it, and on, something that isn't totally random. And has quantum physics been tested? I should put it another way. To what accuracy has quantum physics been tested that it is totally random processes go on instead of quasi-random processes? Because it seems to me that somehow this would be saying something about quasi-random, not totally random processes, and the more copies came into the universe, the more random, if you will.
Yes.
Yes. Is that an answer to that question about the testing of quantum theory? Yeah.
Indirectly. So, of course, the group of Anton Seiding and friends, they have produced random numbers with photons and beam splitters, for instance. And it seems that these systems are more or less the best random number generators that you can get, or people are designing, selling them for commercial purposes for win today or whatever. But of course, they're always finite sequences, finite numbers of elements. And in principle, you can always come up with the argument that this is just a pseudo-random sequence, because you need an infinite number of numbers to be really sure that it's
random. But there's a number that can characterize what pseudo-random and separate it from random.
And dozens of different tests, and compared to that, the quantum numbers are the best you can get, but I don't know them all myself. So, but I can give it a list of the reference.
I would be interested.
Okay.
You're proposing that time is fundamental. In what sense does a fundamental particle have a time?
I don't think that a single fundamental particle, quote, has a time. The claim that time is fundamental is the time that the properties, that the real ontology of the world is properties of systems of the world at a given time, which doesn't require that every particle be a clock or every particle carry its own time, etc.
Is there anywhere in this theory the potential for faster than light signaling that would be disallowed by relativity?
I think in the science fiction idea in which you and somebody, space-like separated from you, makes large quantum systems which are among the few copies of each other, the only copies, and the copying thing goes on, yes, there would be a... Just like in Antony Valentini's work, if you take a system of particles described by the Bohm model and you put it out of equilibrium, there's the possibility of faster than light, out of quantum equilibrium where the statistical distributions are the same as psi squared of the wave function, then there's a possibility of faster than light communication. I think this falls under that general situation.
When you use the word universe in the beginning,
wasn't sure, did you specifically mean space-time, or what did you actually mean? And then the follow-up question would be, when you talk about time is fundamental, what about, you know, the relation between proper time and the metric, and let you get the wrong.
Good. So the first question, to answer the first question, you have to have a notion of causality or causation. And let me note that one needs a notion of causality or causation, which is not in obedience to law, because the assumption is that we're talking about a description of the world in which laws are temporary, but there's an ontology which transcends law, temporary law. So you need the notion of causation. Once you have a notion of causation or causality, you can talk about whether or not different events have common causal pasts. And in the causal set, there's a name for that, a least upper bound or something like that. And so there's a notion of a set of events being causally complete that the causal set people use. And I would be happy with that notion. So the universe is a causally complete set of events, in the sense that any two events in it share sooner or later a common, at least one common past event. And with relationship to proper time, the notion of time and shape dynamics of preferred time given by the CMC slices does not necessarily accord with the proper time of some freely falling particle in the universe.
And I didn't understand that you were giving the example of photon flux. Isn't that something that would be empirically verifiable? Like if you replace this
No, because that's just that's a little hand waving story. But the hand waving story has behind it the fact that there's a mathematical equivalence between the dynamics given here and the dynamics given here. In other words, in this context, there is a global Hamiltonian which evolves this system, which doesn't have a many-finger time gauge invariance, such that the value of any observable or the space-time which is generated is the same as the space-time that would be generated in general relativity. Given a three surface, which is a CMC three surface, given initial data on that three surface, you can evolve and find a solution of the Einstein equation. And you can evolve using a global Hamiltonian and find a solution of shape dynamics. And they represent the same space-time. That is, they have the same four-dimensional space-time metric, light cone structure, geometry, et cetera.
Is it true that we evolve making a choice of labs? The CMC condition, we generically end up in situations where the evolution is still defined. We have crossings.
My understanding is that there's a large subspace of the solution space of general relativity, which is completely CMC foldable. But Flavio is an expert in the back. What's the exact statement? I mean, the exact statement of CMC foliability of solutions of the Einstein, compact solutions of the Einstein equation. Right, but that's a large set of solutions within the space of initial data. The question is, how large of a space of solutions is that within the initial data? Or is it generic that there are obstacles to the evolution of CMC slicing?
I'm not expert in this particular thing, but in CMC slicing is pretty popular. For example, many of them. So it's that there is a very large set of solutions. And I think that also closed loops are.
Yeah, Let's discuss offline. I think for asymptotically flat, there are clear issues like horizons and Schwarzschild. CMC slices don't go to the singularity.
But for large, you can say the Sitter space times, which are Schwarzschild, the Sitter, following the same default. I don't know.
I'm not sure because there isn't the condition of maintaining something conditioned way out at infinity. But let's discuss.
Another question over here.
I'm just curious if your ideas have any contact with the circle of influence. I saw something on a slide that reminded me of it. Dinkin said, suppose that I perform a lot of identical trials. Every time I get the same result, I perform a new trial that's identical. I expect to get the same result. You ask me why, and I say, I'm just inferring. Every time before I got this result, I'll probably get it now. And you can ask me, well, how do you justify inference? And I'll say, well, every time in the past that I've inferred something, it's worked out. Every time in the past, if I've had a lot of trials and I've made an identical trial, the identical trial results like this previous trials. So I need to use inference in order to justify inference. And there's this important relationship with time.
Right. So if I understand correctly, and I'm not an expert on Hume by a long way, what the issue here is not inference, so it's not related to Hume's notion of inference. The notion here is a postulate of causation. That is, it's not just that we observe A has always been followed by B, but that the fact that A has always been followed by B in some sense causes A to be followed by B subsequently. So it's a different notion.
I saw on one slide about something like when you're characterizing current views, it looked to me like you were saying that people currently are saying things happen like this just because it happened in the past.
Well, so usually people follow up a judgment of inference, or often by a hypothesis that there is a law which is immutable, which acts in all cases, which explains the success of the inference. And I'm proposing to substitute that with a different hypothesis about causation, which, and by the way, I'm very happy to the response to these two ideas. I'm very happy with the critical response because my intention, so much of theoretical physics falls outside of what's empirically checkable. I like to play games where I do the following, where I try very hard to invent ideas which are easily falsifiable in the hope that eventually one of them may survive. But I think it's a different strategy than working more abstractly. So I'm very happy if people point out five different ways to falsify each of these ideas.
Well, we may or may not know what time is, but the kitchen does. So I would suggest that we now go for lunch.
Thank you.